This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. Today, I'm with artist Troy Nyman. Welcome, Troy.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Troy, I think that what I find the most remarkable about your artistic trajectory is that it seems really organic. It seems like it's been less about setting out to achieve specific goals and more about like habitual practices that have carried on, you know, throughout your childhood, carried consistently all the way into today. Talk to us a little bit about that, some of those common threads that started when you were a kid.
I'd always had an interest in art of different forms. Those were always my favorite classes growing up. And up into high school, I had some really great art teachers that really helped kind of push me to pursue that a little bit more. My other interests of bicycles, discarded items, and scrap metal all kind of came together later on after post high school. I went to Madison Area Technical College out of high school in Madison, Wisconsin, and took a welding diploma there. And I was probably one of two people in the whole class that were interested in taking it for artistic reasons of just wanting to be able to know how to do it so that I could make things I wanted to make and then create art that I wanted to create. But it just seemed like a really useful skill to have. And one of the first things that we were told in class is that once you learn how to weld, you can really go anywhere in the world and get a job because everything is either welded or made by something that's welded. So I thought that was a pretty interesting thing that there's always something to fall back on there. But really the creative use of that process was really what I was looking for at the time. And then after moving to Tucson, I found a place called Bikus here in town that was taking old bicycles and fixing them up into bikes, and whatever couldn't really be used for bikes anymore or was beyond repair, they were taking that and making these cool scrap metal sculptures and functional items like bike racks and trash cans that were down on 4th Avenue and scattered all around town at the time. And I just fell in love with that idea of taking my new interest in welding, my love of bicycles, and my interest in, you know, reducing and reusing things that are plentiful, and in that case it was bike parts and scrap metal. And so combining all of those passions, I've got 14 years of Bikus art auction pieces that were always really fun to work on, as well as working on countless projects with schools and nonprofits and the city, and then sort of leading into doing public art later on.
Full disclosure, I am a huge fan of the Bikus art auction. And when I became aware of it, I don't know, a decade ago or something, people were telling me about it and they were like, and then this guy Troy had these pieces. It was like an enormous thing. It was amazing. And it really helped to feed into this overall incredible energy that still is a hallmark, I feel, of the Bikus art auction. You go there and you see so many different kinds of art, from, you know, something that maybe a 5-year-old did to something that a really well-known established artist did, all of these pieces in the same room being given the same kind of spotlight and appreciation, and everybody bidding, hoping that they're going to get lucky and get a really incredible piece of art for, you know, a steal, which doesn't really happen anymore because the event is really popular now. Tell us a little bit about those days when you started making bigger and bigger pieces for the Bikus art auction and what that was like.
Yeah, it's such a fun event. I don't know what's going to happen with it this year, but it's been going on for over 20 years now. And I'm sure it will keep going into the future as well in one form or another. But yeah, it's such a fun thing to work towards. And that was one of the first things when I started volunteering at Bikus for a while and then working there, and we had access to the parts in the shop as well. And so just sort of picking out ideas, I always kind of started with like real simple little pieces where you kind of pick up a few things off the floor around the shop and you're like, okay, well, this could be maybe a little, you know, little creature or just a simple little coat rack or something. And you just start with that and then keep going. And oftentimes you've got other people making things next to you, and you can kind of have these little art assembling parties, and you're bouncing ideas off of each other. And then I would typically pick like one bigger piece that I would put a lot of hours into to try to outdo myself from the year before, which is always really fun. And I find that I think a lot of artists will find that, you know, when you're doing work just for yourself, really, and this was work that was for the Bicus Art Auction, but, you know, it's just something that's completely uninhibited, and there's no monetary value put to it. And those really can just be the most fun pieces to make. And also just, you know, being younger and having a little more free time to kick around the shop and put all those hours into it. If I have a client that I'm building something for, and a lot of times they'll say, hey, I want something kind of recycled and sort of industrial. And that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So coming up with different versions and coming back to that. Or in the case of these public art projects, you know, a lot of times you'll have, you know, a few or several people that are all involved with the panel that have their different ideas on what they want to see or what they're okay with. And so you end up kind of re-envisioning this thing several times, often to get to something that everybody's happy with and I'm happy with. Yeah, when you're doing something just for yourself, when you're building something for the Bicus Art Auction, I can really just let it fly, let it loose, and have fun with it. And, you know, it's some of these things that take 30 minutes to make can sell for a lot of money. And sometimes things that I've made that have put many, 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 many hours into will sell for $100. And, you know, it's like coming up with things that I think other people will like and I'm happy with and I'm excited about. And every year I'll try to come up with some, you know, some idea that I'm happy with and can pursue and have the time to work on.
Well, the amount of hours that you put into some of those pieces over the years, I think, has been really, really evident and has been a part of the energy of the Bicus Art Auction when, you know, you walk in the door and see a huge piece that has so many tiny pieces welded into it, and it just screams out 100 hours or whatnot. Could you describe one of those pieces for us?
The first bigger piece that I made for the Bicus Art Auction was a life-size skeleton that its knees moved and its elbows moved. And it was really cool, but it was also, you know, it's a big thing that people don't really have room for in their house. And, you know, the larger pieces that I've made will oftentimes come to me just with what is available in the shop as well. And so oftentimes I'll go around and say, hey, we've had these, you know, four milk crates full of front bicycle derailleurs for years. They've been sitting here for years. Like, what could we possibly make with these? Okay, well, they kind of look like they could be little feathers or something like that. And so we can disassemble all those and have hundreds of feathers. One year I made a chicken, like a huge oversized chicken out of front bicycle derailleurs just because we had tons of them. And, you know, it's sort of like you get to a point where you're like, okay, are these going to go to the scrapyard or am I going to figure out something we can use them for? But, you know, it's pretty cool too because you have this huge chicken made out of front derailleurs. Each bicycle has one front derailleur on it. And so, you know, really this chicken is made out of hundreds of bikes, you know, or of the just that one particular part. Another year I made a life-size javelina, like the, you know, life size for a large javelina, just because we had crates full of spokes. And so I took thousands of spokes and assembled them into the hairs of a javelina. I've made miniature replicas of airplanes and trains and things like that as well. You know, one of the things I love about the art auction too is you've got hundreds of pieces every year, and there's people that donate something every year, and we're always excited about seeing what they're going to come up with every year. And there's a lot of people that really do make like large, outstanding things that they've put lots of time and energy into and are just really creative folks. And then we've got people that, you know, don't make art very often, that get into it, and they'll come down and get pieces and make jewelry or make it a project with their kids and make something and donate it. And sometimes I think we've had up to 400 pieces before in the art auction, and And it's not always that many pieces, but usually over 200. And it's a whole wide range of functional items and artwork and sculpture and jewelry. And it's always really cool to see what everybody's made and how much it goes for. And then the event itself is just so much fun.
Troy, part of your brand now, I mean, you've really become recognized for using recycled items, reusing discarded items. And I'm sure that you've heard the old one person's trash, another person's treasure. Being that you've been using, reusing, recycling, and reselling stuff that other people have thrown away, what are your thoughts about objects and markets and garbage? You know, just in general, like, what are your philosophies about it?
Yeah, it's hard because I oftentimes, just in, you know, my normal everyday life, will like really overthink things, and I don't, you know, not in a, there's just so much that gets thrown away, and then there's like the packaging and all the stuff, you know, and oftentimes I think I need something, I will research it, I'll over research it, kind of just get overwhelmed, and then just like decide I don't need it in the first place, you know, like think about it until like I don't need it anymore, or think about it in a way where you're like, oh, I actually probably have something that I can use for that, and I don't need to go get that certain thing. If that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, I think oftentimes I have, as a kid, I always found things in the trash. People would just push their whole, you know, garage out onto the curb for like spring cleaning, and there was no brush and bulky or anything. It was just anytime you want to throw anything away, you just push it out on the curb. And so riding to school with my friends, we would oftentimes have this rule of dibs, you know, and if you call first dibs on the bike or whatever you saw from a distance, that, you know, you got it. And so we'd be bringing home bikes, and we'd be bringing home VCRs and all the stuff that we didn't even need, you know, to our parents' house, which they didn't particularly like that much. but it was perfectly good. They were perfectly good items, right? And it just seemed silly that these things were just getting thrown away and put in the trash. But, you know, there's just so much of, there's just an abundance of all these things. And it just always seems silly to me to like buy things that, you know, somebody else has sitting in their shed or somewhere that they're not using. And I think now we have Craigslist and we have tons of thrift stores and we've got Facebook Marketplace and all kinds of different options for like giving things away or selling things we don't need.
Buy nothing groups too.
Yeah, and I actually just started doing that, and it's really great to see these things that like you don't really need, and you just throw it up there, and somebody comes picks it up. It's really easy, and you know, we give stuff away and pick stuff up, and it's just a great way to kind of throw things, you know, trade things around, because you know somebody needs it, right? It seems silly to just throw these things away. You know, Tucson seems so much different than Madison too. Whereas when I moved here, and you'd see something out on the curb and you'd be like, oh, maybe I should go pick that up later. And it would already be gone. And I think Tucson's like really a resourceful place where people, you know, will pick up anything that's even like remotely useful off the curb if it's given a chance, you know, right? Whereas if it throws in a dumpster or someplace where people can't really access it, then, you know, it sort of it seems like you put it on the curb, it'll be gone almost immediately in most cases. But as far as art goes, I started using recycled materials mostly because they were available. And so whether that's in my welding school, you can kind of fish things out of the scrap bin there. And then when it came to using bike parts, there was just an abundance of broken bike parts around. So like whatever's available to be scavenged, use what you got kind of thing, right? But oftentimes using recycled items can be kind of difficult too, because you have to find them, you have to store them. And it's not always just as easy as just like, oh, you can just make me something recycled, right? You have to have access to the materials. So,
but it's true. I mean, just because there can be a lot of discarded X doesn't mean that you have access to all the discarded X that you need to be able to do project Y, right?
I think oftentimes people think that recycled means cheaper, right? You know, if they want. They want something, oh, just feel free to use some recycled pieces. And it's not necessarily the case, because if you can just buy something, you know, buy materials new is oftentimes the faster, cheaper way to do it, as opposed to trying to source the materials from, you know, the scrapyard or Brush and Bulky or wherever it may be. I think you'll find that a lot of times if you go to sort of reused stores, you know, that have reused items, it's oftentimes not that much cheaper than getting new stuff. I mean, it might be a good, better quality or whatnot, but finding things that are used, it's not oftentimes the cheapest option, and you might have to fix something or whatnot, but it's certainly a better option in terms of just consuming more and more new stuff. I'll just say now too that, like, in the case of the public art that I did at the Los Reales landfill here in Tucson, that one of the stipulations for that was that they wanted to use almost, you know, as many recycled materials as possible for that, which really made a lot of sense for being at the landfill to go that direction. But it's actually illegal to pull things out of the landfill, so I had to source all the recycled materials from other places, and it's almost entirely made of recycled materials, but they had to come from different sources besides the landfill where the piece was going to be.
Oh, wow. I did not know that it is illegal to pull anything out of the landfill.
Yeah, which makes sense. I mean, I think, you know, there's just safety things there. It's like, you don't know if it's covered in asbestos or something, you know, and you don't want people just in there digging around. But I think, you know, probably the landfills of the past, you just go dump off some stuff. If you saw something you wanted, you could just pick it up, I think. But I'm sure there's plenty of people that got hurt and... You know, it only takes one lawsuit to change all that, probably, right? But once trash crosses the scales into the landfill property, once it gets dumped off the back of your truck, it's technically, I think, like city property or something, where you can't go as another person and go pick it up and bring it out.
Well, and I don't know about everybody, you know, every neighborhood in Tucson, but if I put scrap metal out on the curb in my alley, a scrap metal guy will come by and pick it up.
Yeah, especially during brush and bulky. I think that's every neighborhood in Tucson.
Just on the regular too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
They will come by and find it and load it up and take it away. And you're right, especially during brush and bulky, which, you know, has become a really fun habitual thing for me. I love to drive around wherever brush and bulky is happening and see what I can pick up, much to the chagrin of my spouse. But that's another
turn it
story.
Into a treasure. Turn it into a treasure.
Exactly. But well, and I feel like too, if you habitually collect items that you think you could turn into art or turn into a project, then you already have them and they're ready to go for when you have the opportunity to work on that. But when you try to do it the other way around, where you're like, oh, I have this idea for a project, and then you try to source the materials, that's when it can be really challenging to find what you need exactly at that time. You kind of almost have to do the process backwards, where you're collecting the materials on a kind of almost habitual basis, and then you decide what the project is going to be based on what you were able to source.
Exactly, yeah. That's really good point. And I actually have a saying, which is, you got to have stuff to make stuff, which is also just an excuse to have stuff. I totally do not believe in the, I haven't used it in a year, I should probably get rid of it, because it seems to me that I can have it for no matter how long I have it. As soon as I get rid of it, I'm going to need it. So I do have a pretty good collection of things that could be useful at some point.
So a question about objects that I really wanted to ask you is, given, you know, what we've been talking about, do you think that people's attitudes around objects are changing? You know, given the circumstances, like we're going through a global pandemic, we're going through some really kind of violent climate change stuff, we're going through such a big moment of reevaluating our lives and our society and the way we do things. Do you think that extends to our attitudes around objects and supply chains?
I definitely think that people's attitudes about objects are changing, although it's so all over the place, right? Like, I mean, I feel like old things that everybody was throwing away when I was a kid, which are now much older, but like those objects now are vintage and valuable, and people are seeking out sort of these objects that maybe are like sometimes better made, will last longer, mm-hmm. or just have a certain like visual appeal to it, which is great. I mean, those things can keep coming up and turning around. I think those things that people were like, oh, it's just an old, you know, lamp or whatever, let's just throw it out. And now, you know, people see the value in those older items and the different popular designs of the past keep coming up again. And I think that's really cool. And then another way, you know, in other times I'll go to restaurants and ask for them not to put all your food on styrofoam plates, and they just look at me like I'm the craziest person in the world. So
I don't know if you're familiar at all with Marie Kondo, and some, you know, I guess there are some beliefs that come from Shinto Buddhism too about items retaining a bit of the soul of the people who they've been involved with, or having some sort of an energy or soul of their own. I think about this myself in more abstract terms of story. Like, I'm thinking about the piece that you described that in essence you had built from hundreds of different bicycles, right? If each piece came from one individual bicycle, then you've got hundreds of different bicycles in that one piece that you made, the chicken. And then, right, with all the feathers that came from all these different bicycles, in a way, you're kind of putting together the energy or the stories of all of those different bicycles, all of those different people who rode those different bicycles. Do you think about that kind of thing at all when you're using reused materials or found materials?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's sort of what makes the recycled pieces so interesting too. And I think my absolute favorite thing is that if I have a nice metal or a bike part or some kind of reused item that sort of has the aesthetic qualities that I like for whatever reason, as a patina or a shape or something. But I think my favorite is that if I know some of that story in advance and I can pass that along to whoever ends up with that piece, is just kind of the best, you know, if you can, that you know whose bike that was and you made it for somebody else that knows that person. We had pieces of rebar from the old 4th Avenue underpass. And I think, you know, a lot of people who have been in Tucson for a long time, like have this connection to this old 4th Avenue and the old underpass and what that felt like to, you know, walk underneath there at night and all that. And, you know, you end up with these little pieces where you can just throw a little chunk of that in here and there. Just kind of point out to somebody like, oh, this is from the old 4th Avenue underpass, and make those connections as the best. I love that.
Do you think any of that is reflected in the sculpture that you did for the Los Reales landfill as part of the 1% for Art program? And just to help our listeners out, if they haven't seen the sculpture, I guess we could kind of describe it as as something like a wave that emulates the landscape of a scrap metal yard. Right, made entirely of recycled material, glass, plastic, tires, just a huge, what would you say, a 30-foot sculptural piece with sculpture birds flying around it. So do you think that your ideology around objects is somehow reflected in that sculpture? Like, were you hoping that when people saw that piece as they enter the landfill, that maybe they're re-examining one more time what they're about to put in the landfill?
The Los Reales sculpture, it's called Edifice for the Unwanted, and it's 30 feet wide by about 16 feet tall. And the call to artists was to use as many recycled materials as possible. And I was actually chosen as one of three artists to compete for the project because of my use of recycled materials in my past work. Then the challenge is just, what are you going to use? How are you going to use it? So my idea with that is just to use as many recycled materials as possible, but they also had to be materials that would, you know, last almost infinitely. So metals, some plastics, tires, glass could be used in there as well, a few places. And so there's a lot happening in there that's not necessarily noticeable from driving past it. But really, it starts on one side of the form of the wave, of just sort of being big chunks of sort of like materials, and then flowing over into more recognizable objects. So on one side is just sort of like big crumpled up sheets of metal and plastic and things, mostly metal, different colors that aren't really identifiable as objects. And then they turn into objects as they're going to the other side. And once they're at the other side, you're like, oh, that's part of a chair. That's part of a bike. You know, you can start to pick things out even from a distance. And so that was sort of the, you know, the idea of that is sort of being part of the cycle of like excavating raw materials and then turning them into materials and that sort of life cycle of using them and then putting them back into the ground again. Or it could also be recycling, you know, taking those materials that already exist and turning them into useful items again. And then there's a nod to the old privies of the past, which were essentially just big holes that everybody would have in their backyards where they'd throw their trash into. And there's a lot of glass bottles in that part of the piece as well, because those tend to be the only things that really exist still from the past. If you dig those holes up, you find glass and dirt, and that's about it. Whereas, you know, in our modern landfills, we will be able to dig them up for generations and generations and find probably lots of plastics and things that probably barely compose at all. But yeah, so there's a lot of little pieces in there. But I want people to be able to pick out objects in this form, which I hope people are just sort of like come to the landfill and find this big wave of trash to be just sort of an interesting piece to have at the landfill. You know, hopefully they can kind of reimagine different scenarios of what they're about to throw away and how it could be reused. You know, I think the reduce and reuse is a lot more important than, I mean, the recycling is much more important too, but reducing and reusing are the first two. And if we reduce those two, we don't have to recycle as much, you know. But also, I think that the Los Reales, you know, it's a 1% for the arts too. And so the improvements that they were doing at the landfill, which was like a whole new entrance and new offices and new scales. And this is a 1% of the for the arts project through the Arts Foundation. And that, you know, just made it, I think it's a very unique thing. Like nobody would expect there to be a sculpture at the landfill, but I think it's really cool. And also I've spent weeks assembling this as everybody drove in. And so I got a lot of comments on it as I was working on it and got to talk to people about it while it was happening. And everybody seemed really excited about it. And it was a good way to use up a bunch of items that, you know, would have otherwise gotten scrapped or thrown away. And it was a fun, really fun project.
Troy, you've been living in Tucson since 2003. How do you think the aesthetic of the city has changed?
When I first moved here, I really liked the aesthetic, but I didn't even know that that was my aesthetic. I just, you know, because of all those things, because of the bicycles and, you know, scrap metal and reuse, I thought Tucson in general kind of had this vibe of just reusing what was around. And I thought that was really cool. And that was not really something that was happening up in Madison where I was from. So I thought that was really interesting. I think there is still a lot of that going on here. You know, those recycled bike racks and trash cans that used to line 4th Avenue have slowly kind of disappeared. And there is still a lot of that hidden around town in little places. But I've found that one time people were wanting more recycled gates and fences and whatnot. And maybe that's changing, sort of the rough recycled aesthetic is changing a bit now. It seems to be slightly more refined, although still, you know, rusty metal and reclaimed wood is very prevalent around town and in establishments and residents in general. I don't know. I see just all the development and Tucson's becoming a little less rough around the edges for better or worse, but there's still places for both aesthetics.
Well, it's funny because, right, like shabby chic is like so in and
right.
Actually ends up being, you know, right. Reproduced.
Yeah, that's true.
New and sold new, right?
They're throwing away the old stuff and then buying the new stuff that looks old, right?
And I wonder, too, sometimes about, like, is it a desert aesthetic, right? Like that our landscape can sometimes seem so sparse that we have a little bit more appreciation or take a little bit more time with every object because we're used to seeing a landscape that seems empty, so things pop out more.
The desert deteriorates some things a lot faster, but but other things will last forever here, right? And so you've got all these, like, steel. Almost everything I make, I just try to keep it the way it is, right? So if it's just bare steel, then just let it rust, right? And if it's got recycled, you know, paint from its previous life, just, you know, let that be, maybe clear coated or something. But, you know, in a lot of places around the country, you don't just let metal rust or it'll be gone before you know it, right? So if you live in a wet climate or near the oceans, you're just fighting rust all the time. Whereas here it's
right.
Like, yeah, just let it rust. Let that be the patina and you don't have to paint it and there's no maintenance and that's great. Otherwise, things that are plastic that are out here just break and turn into dust, plastic dust before you know it. I think there's like a desert aesthetic in terms of that, which is really cool that, you know, there can be sheet metal that's been on a shed for, you know, 50 years and you can just take it down and turn it into a fence or something, you know?
Troy, could you talk to us about a piece of public art that you rather fancy here in Tucson?
You know, I really like, there's a stone curves mural up near Roger, which has been around for a long time and had a lot of different artists kind of collaborate on it. And it's got some metal work, mostly a mural and some tile work as well. And it's really long. And I was probably 25 years old, maybe, or something. It's been up there now and really held up pretty well. That's a really nice piece that's been here since I've been in town, you know, so it's always one of those things that you come across over and over again.
And it's long too. I always feel when I drive past it, it's like it keeps going.
I also really like Joe Connell at Creative Machines made a piece that kind of resembles like a nest of stainless steel that you ride through. It's up on a bike path on Houghton. That's a really nice piece that I like a lot. And I think some, you know, pieces like that that sort of engulf you in a way that you can ride through them or get up close to them, right? As those are my favorite. I get a little bummed out that so much art gets placed like in the middle of, you know, traffic circles to a certain extent, but like, you know, in the middle of medians on really busy roads where you can't get up close to them. One of my favorite pieces is right by the airport. There's a basket that's woven out of steel cables and these steel structures that resemble saguaro and saguaro fruit being harvested. This piece by the airport is one of my favorite pieces, but you can't get close to it, you know? And there's a bunch of really great pieces just along the airport drive there that are terrific, but you can't really get up close to them because you can only drive past them at 35 miles an hour, you know? So I think it's really important that the public art gets placed in areas that the public can get up close and see it and slow down.
And maybe actually touch it and engage with it. I think that's part of the reason why people love the Rattlesnake Bridge, because you can actually go through it and experience it from head to tail.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's functional, which is really cool too, right? You know?
I love it when the recording of the rattle goes off.
Uh-huh.
It scares the bejesus out of you. Well, and I think, too, that we have an endemic problem of thinking about art as separate. And it's like, no, actually, like, if we get artists involved in designing the built environment, you know, more often and from the get-go, earlier and more often,
yeah,
then it's going to be a good thing. And also, if we can think about art not being separate from the built environment, but being like an important functional part of the built environment when it comes especially to public art pieces, I feel, then everything will be integrated so much better. But because we think about it totally separate and the processes are, you know, the development has one process and then the public art percentage that's, you know, associated with the development has a totally separate process, it's just not really as well integrated as I think it could be. And if it were better integrated, then we wouldn't lose out on some of these opportunities, like you're saying, you know, to have the art be more functional and to allow for people to interact with it a little bit more intelligently, a little bit better, a little bit more logically too.
Well, a lot of the call to artists too do have, as part of the design process, there will be options of where the art can be placed, right? If it's a specific roadway corridor, you know, you might be able to put that art anywhere on the whole corridor, but is that corridor a place that people just drive past, or is it a place that also facilitates like walking and biking options and creates spaces that people can actually use. Or I wonder if, you know, if you have that 1% for the arts too, for that one roadway project, does it need to be on the roadway or could it be off the roadway at a park nearby or something like that? You know, oftentimes it's dedicated just for that road, but maybe it could be better used.
Have you seen the giant desert animals? It's a pretty brand new public art project that was just completed. It's called Desert Animal Art Benches and Plant Shade Walls. And it's along Valencia Road.
Jason Butler and Hiro Tashima. Yeah.
Right. Tashima Hirotsune. Yeah, exactly. Those two guys together. So Hiro is
right, that's right.
One of my neighbors. Uh-huh. He lives like a block away. Yeah. And we always walked by his house while he was building the sculptures. And we're like, these are amazing. What is going to happen with these?
Yeah, I love their work. And those guys work on projects together quite a bit. And I've seen a lot of projects both of them have worked on. And that one, we just stumbled upon it, actually, because we were biking past over there and saw these these big sculptures in somebody's front yard. So we rode in and kind of were looking at them, and then Hiro like popped up out of the back of one of them. he was behind it working on it. And so we got to talk to him a little bit about it. But yeah, that's great.
They are exactly what we were talking about, right? Like they provide shade, their benches as well. So they're really inviting people. They're really accessible and they're really inviting people to interact with them the way they're built.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, just such a great place, like gives people a place to sit and relax or congregate again when that time comes.
Troy, I've been asking all my guests a similar question these days. Has your artistic practice changed since COVID-19, or does your art mean something different to you now?
No, I mean, things have been challenging. We have a son at home, been home since March, and doing the online kindergarten now is certainly challenging and providing less time to do all the things, the work that needs to be done. I've actually got two public art projects that are in the works right now that are in fabrication. It's just kind of worked out that I'm just working towards that. So we've been doing design, engineering and approvals for some of these over a year. And so now I'm just, you know, it's all hands on deck to just get them made and installed. So that's actually worked out pretty well because we don't really have to have meetings or anything in the meantime, but I don't know. We'll see how things go as far as the next project or the next sculpture goes.
Do you think that public art is more important than it even used to be?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, again, like, you know, just using these funds to create public spaces that people can enjoy for different reasons. And I think giving people opportunities to, you know, become public artists essentially with some of these projects is really great. You know, it's like provides people opportunity to sort of pursue that as work and as a career while creating spaces that people can use outdoors, which are becoming really important during this time and leading into the months that are actually going to be bearable to be outside. And I'm sure parks and public spaces are just going to become really important spots for the next several months or who knows how long.
Troy, what advice would you give to an emergent local artist, perhaps one who is interested in public art?
The most important thing is to put yourself and your ideas out there. I think that a lot of people would be sort of surprised that there's maybe not as much competition as you think. There may be more opportunities than you think out there as well. So you can get on the artist roster through the Arts Foundation and have some images of past work. I think also if you can come up with some concepts around public art ideas and present those as not something that you've necessarily made, but something that you've thought about and worked on, that's like a good way to move forward. And then just sign up, especially if you can keep your eye out for the different calls to artists around town here locally or nearby. If you can focus on sort of maybe some smaller projects that still might be, you know, several thousand dollars or something that just throw your hat in the ring and see what happens, really. Once you can get something rolling, they sort of become, can just keep working at it. You know, once you got a smaller project and keep that in your portfolio. And again, I have found that also just including different concepts that I've come up with and different renderings for projects that didn't even get built have been helpful for applying for new projects that you might get chosen to build in the future.
Absolutely. I think having renderings is really helpful because, you know, it's not as easy for everyone to understand, to be able to use their imagination to see a vision. So I think sometimes renderings can really go a long ways.
Makes a huge difference. And actually that's, you know, if I was going to point something out, if you can do or find somebody that can do computerized renderings, even if they're even just to the most minimal extent, I think it makes a huge difference. And there's some free programs out there of like SketchUp and GIMP and Inkscape and things that have helped me, which I've really just been learning over the past couple of years. And I've got a couple of like really talented guys that I use that help me with the rendering stuff, and they can do that pretty fast and really well. And that has made a huge difference, you know, where I feel like if I'm hitting a wall, if I've been chosen for a panel and I've been hitting a wall with my sketches and trying to explain the ideas, that a couple of those times I've done the renderings and then people are like, oh yeah, that's great, that's a good idea, you know, and we might change things still, but it's just such a better way to translate things. And I can sketch fairly well in order to get my ideas onto paper, but oftentimes it's just not enough to really translate that idea. I mean, especially if you're talking a giant wave of scrap metal for the scrapyard, it's like a hard thing to really kind of sketch out. So, you know, oftentimes it does take a little bit of money to pay somebody to do some of those things, but especially if you've got the project secured, or oftentimes if you're trying to get the project, it might be worth spending the money on somebody that can do that, or just teaching yourself those skills has been really useful.
Well, I think it's important to mention too that in your case, you, Troy, fabricate your own art, but it is totally possible to enter into a partnership if you're, you know, maybe stronger on design and lacking some of the fabrication skills. You can enter into a partnership with somebody who has the fabrication skills, or even farm out the fabrication entirely and just submit the design too. That's kind of something that I think people don't always think about when they're thinking about public art.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of artists that almost exclusively apply together because they have different skills. And I've worked on projects. One of the projects I'm working on now is with a partner as well. And I oftentimes forget that I don't have to do everything. I don't have to do all of it. And oftentimes just to separate part of that budget for that project for a certain thing. But I've always been kind of the kind of person where I want to come up with the idea, learn how to do it as much myself as possible. And that's been a process, you know, for better or worse that I've done. But I've certainly found that computers are not my thing, and I am slowly learning how to do some of that design. And it's really helpful to design things on computers just because you can measure that piece exactly what you need it to be, you know. But having other people that's, you know, their strong point, you know, they can do it a lot faster and a lot better. And as I get better, maybe I'll do more of that too. But absolutely, there's a lot of public artists that just do the design work and then have other people fabricate it, install it. And that's another way to go too.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Troy.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for doing the show.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. Support for Artist Stories is provided by Benjamin Supply, presenting a full spectrum of hardware and plumbing fixtures for kitchen and bath, and their gallery, Tucson, offering national and local art in both the Tucson Warehouse and Transfer Buildings on 6th Street and 7th Avenue. With products available at will call, they are currently open by phone at 777-7000 and at benjaminsupply.com or gallerytucson.com.